This is the second part of the fourth class, and we're getting to the very end of December 1971. And as I do at the end of every year, I wanted to have a look at publications of the time. Publications of the time, and a couple of crucially important publications is that the very first of Roger Hargreaves' Mr. Men books, the very first one, Mr. Tickle, was published in 1971. Now, okay, it may not go down as the biggest political event of the year. However, it is something about, there's something modern about it. Children's books have become more and more important. This is much less the very moral story of the famous five, you know, Le Club des Cinq, etc. You know, where everybody's very. This is all. It's a little bit naughty and daring, and there is something about people bringing their children up differently. There's a certain liberalisation going on here. This is the basis of my new book, The History of Britain Seen Through the Mr. Men Books. Which I'm preparing. That's a joke. I'm not really at all. Okay, on the other side is a classic of history. Keith Thomas published his Religion and the Decline of Magic. And again, which you could, I mean, this is a major historical book which transformed our vision of that time. And again, this is the sort of thing that you might, if you wanted to, use as an example that, you know, there are positive things to put on the other side of the balance against some very, very hard times of the 1970s. So Religion and the Decline of Magic studied popular beliefs in 16th and 17th century England. This was a landmark study in what religion actually meant to people in these centuries. So it's not about what happened, what the bishops said to each other, which is the traditional historical method. It's about what was the role of religion in everyday life, and how did very slowly magical superstitions disappear and Christian theology and tradition rise, yeah, with sometimes some interesting mixes together where you just put them together, you know. So instead of using magical spells, you pray to a particular saint, because it's the saint of this problem. Yeah. So very, very important book. Wonderful book, incidentally, when you're not studying the 1970s. Two more published in 1971. Ivan Illich's book on the right, Deschooling Society, of great influence, particularly in left-wing circles. He's not British. It was published. It proposed a sharp reduction in the influence of what he considered overly rigid institutions such as schools. So it's about, you know, reducing the institutional rigidity. And on the other side, comic autobiography by Spike Milligan, Adolf Hitler, My Part in His Downfall. It's his memoirs about the Second World War and its particular moment of British history of humour. Which brings us on to 1972, and as normal in 1972, at the beginning of 1972, I have a little bit of statistics for you, and the statistics here are, and I think I even have a, yep, I have a picture. In 1972, 43% of young people left school with no qualifications at all, you know, with no diplomas at all. In fact, we say qualifications, I'm saying diplomas to help anybody who didn't know that. So here's just a couple of examples of qualifications. 43% of young people left school with no qualifications at all. Would you like to imagine the number today?
Maybe 15%.
1%. The number today is 1%. Yeah. So this is partly. This is obviously they're not the same qualifications. That's not the problem. But there's been a huge change there. At this time, in the 1970s, the two most important kinds of qualification are the CSE, Certificate of Secondary Education, and the GCE. The what? The O levels. This is what we call the O levels. At 16, you take the O levels, yeah, the ordinary level. Then the A levels at advanced level. It was a two stream system. Traditionally, if you'd gone to a grammar school, you took O levels, and if you went to a secondary modern school, you took CSEs, which were a lower level. And of course, in this period, then everybody's going more and more to comprehensive schools. And this is still the same English system today, that it's by subject. So when you're 16, you may do two GCSEs, or at the time two O levels, or 10. Yeah. So it's not at all the unitary system as in the French system. Eventually, later, these two will be merged together as part of an attempt at democratization. Because in fact, having separate ones meant that it was difficult to move over from one system to the other. In 1972, there were over 20 million strike days. A strike day is one person on strike for one day. So if a million people go on strike for 5 days, that's 5 million strike days. Between 1953 and 1964, on average, there were 1 million strike days every year. In 1969, there were 7 million. So in 1972, over 20 million. So it's an enormous year for strikes. An enormous year for strikes. Now, the number of strike days measure the level of conflict, but do not tell us anything about who is winning or losing. Because, as I mentioned to you, if a strike is short, it's often because they've won. In the 70s, strikes were on average considerably longer, with both sides digging in, determined to win. In any case, in 1972, there were 11.3 million trade union members in Britain. 11.3 members trade union members in Britain. And here we have a graph of trade union density. Now, that's the number of employees, the number of workers who are in, sorry, the percentage of workers that are in unions. And you can see that it begins in 1900 at around 11%. Very big rise during the First World War and during the beginning of the 20s. Fall until the 30s once the economic recession comes in the fall. Big rise during the Second World War in the 50s. Stable in the 60s, a rise in the 70s when the strikes made people join more trade unions, and then a decline after 1979, down to around here. And if you continue after 2016, it flattens out, it comes over here somewhere. So slight decline after that even. It's not that easy to interpret either, because you can have a lot of people in unions, but the unions are very passive, or you can have small numbers of unions, but if they're in key positions in the economy, like bank workers or something, then they can cause a lot of disruption. In January 1972, the 59% of miners voted to strike. The coal strike began. Coal miners began a strike which lasted for 7 weeks and included the famous picketing of Saltley Coke Depot in Birmingham. This incident became a symbol of the tremendous power which could occasionally be wielded by organised workers, both for union activists who celebrated it and for conservative politicians who deplored it. Saltley Gates. If you say the word even today, this makes trade unionists very happy and conservatives very unhappy. It was the symbol, and it certainly was the highest point. This was the first national miners' strike since 1926 and was accompanied by new picketing tactics. Picketing was a very strong tradition in the British trade union movement and consisted of groups of strikers standing in front of the striking workplace, stopping people entering or trying to persuade them not to enter. Most pickets were very low-key, but the principle of never crossing a picket line was very strong indeed. In the stronger unions like the miners, one could lose all one's friends and contact with one's family by refusing to respect a picket line. There were still a number of miners killed every year at work, and most miners considered that the important advances in health and safety and living standards had been won through worker solidarity, which should never be abandoned. Occasionally, as we shall see at Saltley, the tactic of mass picketing was used. That is, crowds of pickets tried to make it physically impossible for people to cross the picket line. The police would then often intervene to force a way through for the strike breakers. Interestingly, in the 1970s, the police were often not armed even with truncheons for such occasions. So what happened basically is that the strike was spreading around the country, getting bigger and bigger. But there are a couple of coke factories that they produce. They make the coal easier to use, which were still working. And every day, hundreds of lorries were coming out and keeping the power stations working, so making it hard to win the strike. And so the miners came from all over the country to try to stop the workers, the coal lorries coming out or going in. It was a lot of police, it wasn't clear. The leader of the miners, Arthur Scargill, went around the factories of Birmingham and persuaded the car workers and engineering workers in particular to come on strike in solidarity with the miners and to join the demonstration. And he did it in very much the traditional trade union way of the time, but probably more melodramatic. And he said, you know, I do not ask for your solidarity, I demand it. You know, will you? And it's wonderful speeches. You know, will you go down in history as those who stood back while the miners were crushed? That's a very, very powerful stuff. And the huge demonstration of tens of thousands of engineers came to join the thing, and there were just so many of them that the police were obliged to close the gates. And this became, so it's symbolic. I mean, it's one strike, but it's symbolic because there was a whole discussion afterwards, and now we have the papers because the cabinet meetings are published 30 years later or something. They have the papers. And they were discussing, you know, why didn't you send the army? This was the discussion they had. Why should we send the army? Send the army? Well, do you want us to send them with bullets or without bullets, you know? That was the kind of discussion that was going on, you know. So it became also for inside the Conservative Party, for the right wing, that this was considered to be the really, they thought it was the beginning of a revolution, which it wasn't, but they didn't know that. Yeah, they were really absolutely paranoid about this. The Battle of Saltley Gates, one of two or three symbols of the highest level of power of organized workers. And here you have two books that show something about it, about the period. Yeah, Glorious Summer. You see, this is the trade unions were the trade union militants' book on it. Class Struggle in Britain, 1972. Yeah, A Glorious Summer, whereas you know a state of emergency is the Dominic Sandbrook considers that Saltley Gate was a terrible thing. Also in January 1972 was a very, very, very hot situation, and this was a Bloody Sunday. 14 people were killed when troops from the Parachute Regiment opened fire on the demonstrators in Derry. Now, I'm not going to go through this stuff. I've put a video up, and this should be really general knowledge anyway. What is interesting about it is that the explanation that the young men were shot in the back and that they didn't have arms is now the official British government position. Yeah, so it's no longer a question for debate. David Cameron said so. So there you go. But what is more important from our point of view is the results. The day after Bloody Sunday, the easiest job in the world was recruitment organiser for the IRA. Because before Bloody Sunday, there was a big argument. Oh, the best way is to organise a military response. No, the best way is demonstrations. And then thousands of people watched 14 young men shot in the back. There were thousands of witnesses. And so after Bloody Sunday, then the argument between the people who thought a military solution and the people who preferred a political solution, there was no argument anymore. The number of people who are young men, you had all the young men in the street would join the IRA because it was just... and this became important later because the government introduced a new inquiry in 1997 because otherwise there was going to be no end. There was not going to be any peace agreements. That was a first condition. You can understand it. That is to say that the Republican leaders said, you know, we cannot go back and tell our people that nobody cares that their children were shot in front of their houses. You know, that's the if you don't open another inquiry, we're just going home. And if there's a civil war, there's a civil war. You know, because it was too high a thing. As a result of the Bloody Sunday killings, a crowd of protesters used petrol bombs to burn down the British Embassy in Dublin, chanting "Burn, baby, burn." And in the airports of Ireland, the airport workers refused to refuel British planes. Here on the right, you have Bernadette Devlin, who was one of the leaders of the civil rights organisation, and she was famous at this point because in Parliament, the Home Secretary made a statement about Bloody Sunday, and she walked across the Parliament and thumped him. She's like, you know, that was quite a dramatic sort of situation. The situation around the miners' strike led the governments to declare a state of emergency and to institute a 3-day working week because of the shortage of coal. You have to remember how important the coal was. The miners' strike was victorious after 7 weeks, and the miners received a wage increase of around 17%. Some even claimed that the victory was great enough to avenge 1926. 1926 was the previous miners' strike. It had lasted 6 months. They had lost. And it shows something interesting about the psychology of the militant miners as well, because 7 weeks, if you imagine you have no wages for 7 weeks, it takes a long time to compensate for 7 weeks, even at 17%. Yeah. So there's a lot of symbolism behind it. This was also the month of the last episode of the sitcom Please Sir, which was a comic series about everyday life in a secondary school. I will put a link up if you want to watch it, but it's not very funny anymore. The humour of the time seems to be a little slow for us now. Back to Northern Ireland again. So after all that, back to Northern Ireland again. The Parliament of Northern Ireland at Stormont. This was established in 1920, in the 1970s, the only part of the United Kingdom to have a separate parliament as well as the London Parliament was Stormont, and it was controlled by the Unionist majority. And in March 1972, the London government decided to suspend the Parliament. So they kind of closed it. They closed down the Parliament. Since the London government no longer had confidence that Stormont was ready to improve the situation of Catholics in the province, the London government took over control, in particular for police and security. Civil servants were sent to Northern Ireland to run the province. In 1973, a year later, this parliament will be abolished, but immediately replaced by another Northern Ireland assembly devised by the Sunningdale Agreement. But the new Northern Ireland assembly will not last very long. So you've got this whole situation. Of course, there's the problem of the violence on different sides. But you can't understand the situation in Northern Ireland if you don't start from the politics, because it's the politics which is behind the violence. That it's not the other way around. And the Sunningdale Agreement will be one of the things we'll be talking about a little later. Back to London. Oh dear, first of all, I missed this out. I didn't write anything about that. Oh yes, it's a terrible thing. It's because it was six people were killed by an IRA car bomb in Aldershot Barracks, though, so in Britain. So there's a bomb in Britain, and six people were killed by an IRA bomb. Mostly they were civilians who worked for the military. This was presented as a revenge attack for Bloody Sunday. Yeah, so you can see the logic of a revenge attack. Interestingly enough, this bomb was planted by the official IRA. The IRA had splits. There was the official IRA and the provisional IRA. Most of the attacks in the 70s are by the provisional IRA, but not this one. There's Stormont, incidentally. I don't know if you like that, where the Parliament sat before it was suspended in 1972. And I think it's where the Northern Ireland Assembly still sits today. It's very square, just outside Belfast. I went there I went there, but they didn't do anything interesting when I was there except rain. So we're still, by this time then, we're in 1972. The Conservative government has been in office since 1970. Yeah, so they're surviving okay. They've still got their majority. It's up to the Prime Minister to decide when they're going to have an election. Although the majority is reducing because people die and there's a by-election and the government often loses in by-elections in general because they're the government, whatever the government is. And so they're trying to deal with Northern Ireland, they're trying to deal with the miners, they're trying to deal with all these different things, and they're also, of course, having to organise the budget. Anthony Barber's new budget, the Central Exchequer, was intended to be reflationary. Personal allowances for income tax were substantially increased, meaning one could earn considerably more before paying tax. And it was announced that old age pensions, as they were called at the time, were to be raised in the autumn. An industry bill was proposed by the government, which would establish an industrial development executive to help plan and subsidise industrial investment. Exactly the things which they denounced in the manifesto. Its initial budget would be £250 million a year. This was something of a U-turn by Heath, since when he was elected here, denounced excessive planning, considering that the market should be able to take care of industrial development, and had abolished the Industrial Development Corporation set up by the previous Labour administration. So, the Heath government abolished the Industrial Development Corporation and 2 years later established the Industrial Development Executive. It looked like a U-turn. And there he is on television at the time. Notice still got the handkerchief in the pocket, very important. So in some ways it seemed almost like a 1960s Labour budget. But the Labour Party will compensate later on by doing after Thatcher by doing having budgets that look like Thatcherite budgets. In 1972, we have the Peace Festival and march to Aldermaston. Aldermaston is an atomic weapons research establishment where they develop atomic weapons. And this demonstration left 27 black coffins outside the research establishment to symbolise the 27 years since the bombing of Hiroshima. The demonstrators marched for 56 miles, and the choice of such a long demonstration symbolised the strategic choices of the campaign at this time. The most important thing for them was to make a strong moral protest by a minority of people and not to have a mass demonstration. If you have a mass demonstration, of course, you don't make it 56 miles long. Nuclear weapons and demonstrations against them are an important part of post-war British history. Although the traditional socialist view of such weapons was that they were unacceptable since they could not be used to kill only soldiers, Clement Attlee had decided to develop independent British nuclear weapons in the late 1940s. And there you have the Peace Festival, including some interesting guests. John Peel, who's a young avant-garde disc jockey, who produced a late night show where he would play stuff that nobody else would play, and much of it was never heard of again. But he did introduce some of the great people there. Adrian Henry and Adrian Mitchell, interestingly enough, are poets. So they're there to tell their poems, yeah? It's a particular very 1970s atmosphere to that. Yeah, admission free, come early at Aldermaston. Then Hawkwind is progressive rock, I think. William Whitelaw was appointed as the first Secretary of State for Northern Ireland when they had Stormont running. They didn't need a Secretary of State. Now they needed a Secretary of State, and it was William Whitelaw. William Whitelaw was a leading Conservative politician, and later, when Edward Heath was to resign, he was considered to be the most likely successor. and his defeat by Margaret Thatcher in the subsequent leadership election surprised almost everybody. In April 1972, there was also a report into the Bloody Sunday shootings by the Lord Chief Justice, Lord Widgery, and he exonerated the British troops and said that they were firing in self-defence. In the London police, very symbolic moments when Robert Mark was established as the new head of the Metropolitan Police and the London Police in April 1972. He is well known for having set up a wide-ranging scheme to root out corruption in the Metropolitan Police, and in particular in the Criminal Investigation Department, where it was known that officers ran protection rackets. So protection racket, do you know what a protection racket is? Well, it's very simple. You go and see the pubs and you say, you know, if you give me £50 a week, you will never have any problems. That's a protection racket. And you know, and of course the pubs gave the money, because otherwise, you know, the police, I found drugs in your toilets, I'm going to close the pub, you know, something, you know, that they have the power. This is very interesting point, yeah. And he was famous, was Robert Mark, for having said, a good police force is one which arrests more crooks than it employs, which is quite a shocking thing for the leader of the London Police to do. But it does show something that has changed a lot since the 1970s, because certainly, although, of course, there are many problems with the police today, as there always are, you do not get that kind of corruption today. You don't get policemen running protection rackets. Now, this is partly because the type of crime has changed, and so the London police at the time were well known for being friends with the criminals, you know, but this was gangs of criminals. Now, you don't have gangs of criminals in the same way anymore. It's not the same. So it's a different sort. And also, many of the, of course, small businesses are not so important. And so, because there's more big businesses, and so there's not the same atmosphere. But certainly, it's true that he did get rid of, and people were. Yet more than 500 officers were dismissed or made to resign. Two top chiefs were imprisoned. And so it's this very serious thing. But I think it's very, very interesting. Also, again, if you're looking for a positive side to the 1970s from the point of view of public action, Sir Robert Mark is a good example to go for. So, let's move on to May. May, what year are we in these days? May 1972. There was a change in the criminal courts. The new Crown Courts were established to replace the Courts of Assize and the Quarter Sessions. And this also was accompanied by another change in the law. Before May 1972, if you wanted to, to be on a jury, to serve on a jury, you had to be a householder. That is to say that you had to have a certain stable situation in society. So a whole part section of the poor were not allowed to serve on juries. And so this was changed at this point. So this was a modernization of the criminal courts and a further advance in the democratic spirit. Now, I'm not sure exactly what the definition of a householder was. Yeah? I don't think it necessarily means that you own your house. But, for example, if you are just staying with friends because you don't have enough money to have your own house, then you wouldn't be a householder. Let's say that the idea of being a householder was an idea that, you'd be a responsible citizen if you're a householder, whereas if you were not, you might not be, yeah, etc. So a sort of elitism. In many ways, the 70s was a democratic decade with increasing individual freedom and a continuing slow decline of deference. But some undemocratic institutions, such as the monarchy and the House of Lords, undertook no reform at all. Indeed, the Civil List Act of 1972 established that additional members of the royal family, as well as the Queen, would receive an income from taxpayers. And the House of Lords would only be radically reformed in 1997. Around the world, changes in ex-colonies continued with the change with the British Dominion of Ceylon becoming the Republic of Sri Lanka, renouncing then links to the British monarchy. Notice that this is not the independence. Ceylon had won its independence in 1948 and become a British dominion. But the move to a republic cut the final constitutional ties with Britain. So the Queen was no longer the Queen of Ceylon. This is not just symbolic, because it was also the case that until this time, the highest appeal court for citizens of Ceylon had still been in the United Kingdom. That is to say, they're like the equivalent of the Supreme Court was in Britain until this point. So it's not just symbolic, although. The same month, the official Irish Republican Army declared a ceasefire in Northern Ireland, but only the official one and not the provisional one. Another treaty was signed between the United States and the Soviet Union, the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty called SALT I. In fact, the United States and Soviet Union signed this month the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty. This treaty led to strict limitations on the building of defensive weapons against incoming nuclear missiles. The intention was in this way to ensure that deterrence would function. Although many critics were skeptical about the theory of deterrence altogether, the signing of this treaty demonstrated ongoing communication between the superpowers and a continuing atmosphere of détente. The SALT I treaty was also signed this month, effectively freezing the number of intercontinental ballistic missiles, missile systems. Back in Britain, in June 1972, the very first issue of the influential, I would say massively influential, feminist magazine, Spare Rib, was published. Initially, many newsagents refused to stock it, but quite rapidly it sold around 20,000 copies a month. So influential was it that a couple of years ago, or last year, the British Library had decided to put online the entire collection as a digital collection, and certainly it was something very impressive. Here we have a couple of them on the left. Then, what was new about it is it tried to have quite a popular form. Yeah, lots of photos, interviews with famous people, rather than just a straightforward political newsletter for activists. This is what was going wider. And so, for example, you can see on June 1972 on the right, you have Georgie Best on sex. Yeah, so, you know, which is a more populist sort of, I haven't read it, and so on and so forth, yeah. Lots more inside. On the right, in 1978, you have another couple of examples, which I'll talk about later, actually, about reclaiming the night. I will come on to reclaim the night later. Still interesting to read. It basically came out of the left-wing movements and was set up by a series of women who were rather fed up of women and women's issues not being taken seriously in left-wing organizations. You can't really talk about typical feminists in the 70s. There were so many different sorts. And it's true that some women left the left-wing organizations because they found that it was impossible to get them to take women's issues seriously. But then other women stayed in them and became leaders of the left-wing organizations. So it's like, you know, it's horses for courses, as I believe the expression goes. A new law was passed entitled the Fire Precautions Act. From June 1972, all hotels and boarding houses had now to obtain certification from the fire service to say that they were safe. The procedure which led to this law had been launched after a fire in a hotel had killed 11 people in 1969. In the 1970s, there were in London around 150 deaths in fires every year. Today, the number is around 60. So again, we often think of the welfare state as only concerning health, education, old age pensions, and help for the unemployed. But it also includes an interest of the state in many different aspects of improving people's lives, notably health and safety regulations, food hygiene regulations, and so on. On the 23rd of June, the Chancellor of the Exchequer, Anthony Barber, takes the decision to float the pound. And just to give you the image there, you'll have two pictures on the left of the currency at the time. I remember these, which are, have disappeared many, many years ago. Notice that there are also, that not only English pounds, there are also Scottish pounds, which you can also spend in England. This is symbolic, in just like the Scotland has its own education system, it also has its own banknotes. Doesn't make any difference, but it does make a difference because it's a symbolic difference. It's about nationhood.
I was told when I lived in Scotland that you couldn't use them in England. Well, some shops would refuse them.
Yes, they're not supposed to, but they do. They do sometimes refuse them, yes. So you have to find a shop in England run by Scots. And on the right you have then Anthony Barber. What is he carrying? This is very, very fascinating here.
It's a briefcase they all have with secret papers on bottom.
Well,
paper.
Yes, but have you seen what shape it's in? It's very battered. And this is because for the budget, they use the same one every year for decades and decades and decades. And so it's not an accident. It's not that he can't afford a new one. It's a tradition that they do it with this battered thing. And that's just so British to have these old, silly traditions, really. Of course, in France, we don't have old, silly traditions. No, of course not. To float the pound, what does it mean to float the pound? To float the pound means to accept that for at least a period, quite a long period, the market will decide how much the pound is worth. When you're the government, you have to make decisions about the value of your currency. I have it officially from a member of the jury of the Agrégation that they will not be asking technical questions about finance because they don't understand them either. Nevertheless, dealing with the currency is an important part of government things, and sometimes you have to make decisions about the value of the currency, in particular against the dollar, which is the world standard. Now, such decisions are often not easy to make or easy for lay people to understand. If the pound is strong, for example, if the pound goes up, imports are cheaper. It's cheaper to import things. But this can help British firms buying in raw materials. On the other hand, if the pound is weak, if the pound goes down, that can be good because this means that exports are cheap and the foreign countries will buy more exports. So the thing is to find the right balance. I don't know what it is, yeah? But these are questions. Certainly, one thing that you don't want when you're the government is for too much instability or a sharp fall. So a gradual fall may be considered a good thing, just like a gradual rise, whereas a sharp rise or fall is generally pretty dangerous. Yeah. Okay.
Is float the pound is the same as devaluation or
not? No. To float the pound is to say, for 3 months we will not intervene.
Okay.
So, yeah, it normally means it will devalue itself. July 1972, the first official Gay Pride March was held in London. So this was, I'd already showed you the first. It's very difficult to define the first because I think the other one was the first Gay Rights March, and this is the first Gay Pride. It's not exactly the same thing, but it's very close. In July 1972, there was a decision made about the prisoners in Northern Ireland, because, of course, they had all these prisoners in Northern Ireland who hadn't had a trial. And so the government decided that they would have special category status. That is that they would not be treated like criminals, but fundamentally like prisoners of war. They would be allowed to meet freely, have political meetings, receive newspapers. They would not have to wear prison uniform. This was tremendously important to Republican, whether they were members of the IRA or just supporters of the Republican cause, because it was extremely symbolically important to them to say to the world, we are not criminals. Okay, we're prisoners of war, we're not criminals. And this is the fight which will lead to the hunger strikes in the beginning of the 1980s. A series of IRA explosions in Belfast city centre killed 9 people and injured over 100. These were, I think, economic targets. And there was a big argument about the IRA said, you know, we phoned in a warning, and then the government, the police said, no, you didn't. And normal sort of situation. There was another symbolic moment for the power of trade unions. There was 5 dockers who had been sent to jail because they had been involved in illegal picketing, and they had been fined, but they refused to pay the fine. And the judge said, "Well, we'll send you to jail if you don't pay the fine." And they said, "Okay." And so they were sent to jail, and the jailing of the 5 was supposed to serve as an example to the trade union movement to intimidate it. However, on the contrary, tens of thousands of workers came out on strike to protest against the jailing of these 5 workers. Most of the national newspapers stopped publication, and it was very easy to spread this strike. In fact, I mean, I spoke to one guy who said that himself and his friend stopped Heathrow Airport. Yeah, they arrived at Heathrow Airport. They said, "Can I speak to the union leaders?" They said, "Look, 5 of our dockers have been sent to jail. We want you on strike." And Heathrow Airport stopped. But this was the 1970s. Yeah, there was an incredible atmosphere of solidarity. And so the government had a problem, because it's only 5 people. But you see, the thing is that, in theory, the government cannot suddenly release prisoners. It's not a dictatorship. It's a democracy, separation of powers. This is the judge's problem. Yeah, and so just because the Prime Minister cannot suddenly say, "Okay, release this person," not in theory, they have no power over that. But in practice, they found a very, very obscure law which hadn't been used for decades and decades, and they sent the official solicitor. Nobody knew who this was. Nobody knew what it was. But they found a cheap way, and the dockers were released from the prison. And there was an enormous party, and it was a very humiliating government defeat for the government. The reason they did it is that the trade union congress called a one-day general strike for the following Monday. And when even the trade union congress, were not very radical people, were calling for a general strike, they knew that there would be a general strike. And there's a moment when it's better to stop. The next month, August, was marked mostly by questions around racism. And in fact, what happened is that in Uganda, which was an ex-British colony, the dictator Idi Amin announced that 50,000 Asians, well, mostly Indian, in fact Indians, who had British passports, as most Indians did, or almost all, or what most Indians could anyway, were going to be expelled from Uganda. So it's kind of ethnic cleansing, not quite so violent. But he said, the Indians are sabotaging our economy. We're going to expel 50,000 Indians from Uganda. Now, the history of this went back into the history of the British Empire, because, you see, the British Empire was a very racist setup, of course, and so they didn't like to have African civil servants in Africa. So they imported from India Indians to act as their middle classes. And so, of course, nobody likes the intermediate. You know, they get hated because they're in the middle. And when the British left, then the tensions were kept. And so, the question for these were 50,000 Indians who lived in Uganda who had the right, in theory, to come to Britain. And the government decided that they were going to accept them, but this caused a wave of activity among racists, and in particular the hard right Monday Club launched a campaign around the slogan "Halt Immigration Now." And so here are the Ugandan Asians arriving in Britain. So it was a bit of a shock for them. Yeah, these were people who perhaps had a small business or something, and suddenly, you know, you've got 3 months to leave the country. It's pretty heavy. The age at which young people were allowed to leave full-time education was raised to 16. It had been 15, it was raised to 16. And that age was to be further raised to 18 in 2015. September 1972 also saw the first broadcast of two very famous programmes, the BBC quiz programme Mastermind and the sitcom Are You Being Served, set in a department store. Perhaps more important, the second Cod War. Now, Cod War, of course, it's a slightly jokey thing, Cold War, Cod War. This was a conflict which occasionally became military between Britain and Iceland. Now, normally you wouldn't expect Iceland to risk any military conflict with Britain because Iceland is really small. This was about fishing rights. It was the second Cod War was, like the first one, was triggered by the sinking of two British trawlers. There were two big British fishing boats which were fishing in an area which the British considered to be their area and the Icelanders also considered to be their area. So it was a conflict about who had the rights to fish. And at one point the Icelanders said, okay, well in that case we will sink your fishing boats. So they did. Which is quite cheeky when you're a small country. Certainly Britain had the military capacity to invade Iceland without noticing. But of course, politics doesn't work like that. The military capacity is not enough. And at the end of the story, the Icelandics will actually win because they, if I remember rightly, but I'll be able to tell you for sure next week, they say, "Oh well, you know, we're members of NATO, but we could leave NATO," and threatening to leave NATO was enough. Because of course there's a political stability. If you've got something like NATO, which is important to the West, if one country leaves, even a small country, that makes things rather unstable. Carrefour. This is a story about the French. Carrefour opened in September 1972, the very first UK hypermarket in Caerphilly, the hypermarché. In fact, the word hypermarket was first coined in French as hypermarché in 1968. And in September, thousands of Ugandan Asians, I just mentioned, they arrived Britain. Better news in October 1972, bringing us back to the question of women. You can see we've got about 10 streams going on. The trade unions, Northern Ireland, women's... Not 100, but, 10 or so going on. And here's an episode... women's history, October 72, three colleges of the University of Cambridge, Churchill, Clare and King's, admitted women students for the first time.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I lived in Cambridge for a year. That was in 71.
Uh-huh.
I had never thought there were so many women students by then.
The story of women at Cambridge is a long one. In the 19th century, there were separate colleges. There were two separate colleges established for women: Girton College and what's the other one called? Newnham.
Magdalen.
No, that was a men. It was only men. It was only men. Yeah. However, when they established them in the 19th century, they were not allowed to take exams. When the colleges were established, they were for 40 people or so. They were very small. Yeah. They were not allowed to take exams. And eventually they persuaded sympathetic Cambridge lecturers to set mock exams just for the women. But they couldn't have diplomas for a long, long time. the pioneers were very brave women because I remember some of the pioneers in Edinburgh, they got the right to go to medical lectures, although they couldn't have the diploma. They went one day, there were five women, I think, who went to medical lectures in Edinburgh. And the next week for the following lecture, the men came with pigs and goats because they said, now animals are allowed to come to lectures. Yeah. And now it's kind of, you have to be quite distant to laugh at it. You can imagine that it was... You can imagine they must have been brave women to come back in that sort of situation. Yeah. It reminds you a little bit of black and white segregation in the United States. They're really very, very... In any case, there they were being admitted for the first time. Also in October 1972, the lifting of restrictions on broadcasting hours permitted the extension of daytime television. Now, this is important, daytime television. It's not necessarily very good, but notice what was happening before. Why did the law restrict broadcasting hours? Well, it's a kind of anti-state, if you like. Anti as in uncle state. Yeah, it's the kind of, we're looking after you. It's not good for you to watch television all day, so we're going to have a law that says you can't have television in the morning. That's the sort of atmosphere. And so the lifting these restrictions is part of liberalisation. It's part of the idea that, well, you know, it isn't very good for you to watch television all day, but it's your problem, and the state is not going to do it. A reorganisation. John Betjeman became the poet laureate. You know, we have an official poet in Britain, appointed to the Queen, the poet laureate. At the moment, it's Carol Ann Duffy. She's very good indeed. They're often very good poets, and John Betjeman was appointed poet laureate. This is also the very first episode of a soap opera, Emmerdale Farm, a soap opera set in rural Yorkshire. Soap opera set in rural Yorkshire. It's also in October that 3,000 tenants in Liverpool began a rent strike to protest against having to pay more. The government, the Conservative government, had passed a law, the Housing Finance Act in 1972, which obliged local councils to raise the rents so that they were close to market value. So this is, an ideological and economic conflict. On the one hand, you have people who said, okay, council house rents are lower than the market value, but that's good because it's a social service. It's to help people who don't have any money. At least for this Conservative government, that is a problem. And so sometimes you're obliged to go below market value, but it's a problem. And so they passed a law to oblige councils to approach market value. That was the idea, yeah. And they said that their justification was, oh, you know, taxpayers have to pay more tax because councils are keeping the rents down. Yes, this is the argument. The rent strike lasted over a year. It spread to a number of towns. Here you have Clay Cross. In some towns, it was supported by the local council, it was pretty much successful. They made it last until the government changed, and then they won. Yeah. So the rent strike, and I have a video on that that I'm going to give you. We have to get you to understand some Liverpool accents. Yeah. Some wonderful Liverpool accents. In December 1972, the Nobel Prize for Medicine was awarded to British biochemist Rodney Porter, jointly with a US colleague, for their work on antibodies. And there you have a picture of an antibody. I'm sorry, I couldn't find anything else to illustrate that. That's an antibody. This is not Spaghetti Junction, but this is an antibody. And in 1972, the Christmas number one was by an American, by Jimmy Osmond, a child singer from the United States, entitled, I'll Be Your Long-Haired Lover from Liverpool. I'll put this on the blog for you because it's got to be listened to, although it may make you want to execute children. It's pretty bad. The text is, I'll be your long-haired lover from Liverpool, you'll be my sunshine lady from LA. There you go. It's very 1970s. Inflation fell during the year to 6.4% from 8.6%. And British car production reached its peak with more than 1.9 million cars produced during the year. So almost 2 million cars. Interestingly enough, that was its peak for the 1970s, but Britain is back to that level today. However, today it is Japanese companies with factories in Britain doing it, and of course there are far, far, far fewer workers. The death toll in Northern Ireland for 1972 was 103 soldiers, 41 police, and 323 civilians. You don't need the exact numbers, but you know, you see the sort of... and it's quite a small place, you know. It's not huge numbers of people in a way, but it's quite a small place, you know, so it's certainly... what was published? What were the big publications of the year? Oh, there you go, 1.9 million cars. I had great difficulty getting a picture of a 1950s car, but of a 1970s car, but that's a 1972 car, that's what they looked like. Publications of the year, British publications, most, and actually, no, they're not all British publications, because sometimes they're just influential ones, but this is a British publication, Richard Adams novel, Watership Down, a children's favourite about a tribe of rabbits, one of which has extrasensory perception. It sounds unlikely. It was later made into a cartoon film. I highly recommend it. It's not famous in France, is it? Which is amusing because British children's classics are often well known in France. Whether it's Harry Potter or the Hobbit or C.S. Lewis's Narnia and so on. A blueprint for survival was printed by the Ecologist magazine. And I already mentioned that at this point, at this moment, the people who are the small groups who are active around the environment tend to be rather catastrophist. I mean, look, a blueprint for survival. Yeah. You're all going to die. Yeah. That's the, you know. Whereas in general, although ecological groups underline the seriousness of the various challenges, they don't normally go for this kind of thing anymore. A rather apocalyptic document, even though it was signed by dozens of leading scientists. A few years later in Britain, once the Ecology Party had stabilised as a small political organisation, a more sober tone was taken with the publication of a book, Policies for a Sustainable Society. And you see the difference, yeah, a blueprint for survival, Policies for a Sustainable Society. You know, it's a bit more relaxing. Tremendously important book, published in 1972, not famous. This is psychology. Michael Rutter published Maternal Deprivation Reassessed, which contradicted previous consensus among psychologists. Previously, the very widespread idea was that the absence of the mother for small children was always psychologically dangerous. And so if mothers went back to work too quickly after having children, then they would definitely damage their children psychologically. That was the old idea. And Rutter found in a very wide empirical study, it's a book of science, it's not a book of opinion, it's a book of science. In a wide empirical study, it was shown that disputes inside the family, rather than maternal absence, were the key danger. Politically, this was tremendously important, as the previous thesis had been used by those who felt that mothers should stay at home with their children and not go out to work. In the 1970s, it was still not unusual for mothers who went out to work to be criticised for this. The expression latchkey kid existed to refer to those presumably unhappy children who had their own key to their house, because when their mother was out when they came back from school. So that makes it sound like a distant world in a way, but it's not so far away. And this is a very interesting thing because it's a scientific survey, but very, very symbolically symbolic and important in giving more opportunities to mothers. You know, that you could be a mother and something else, and you didn't have to be just a mother, which of course is one of the tremendous advances of the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s, really, because it was very long. It all took a very long time. And that's all. We've got to the end of 1972, so I'm not going fast enough, am I? I will do calculations to make sure that I get to the end before the end, okay? But I will be back next week with 1973.